This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Coming up, some in the Twin Cities Muslim community are expressing doubts about an FBI program to gather intelligence about potential terrorists. A lawmaker wants any potential video from police body cameras to remain confidential. And a new youth homeless center is opening in Brooklyn Park. It's Friday, January 30th. I'm John Wanamaker. Some civil liberties and Muslim community groups are scrutinizing the intent of a federal anti-terror program that will launch next month in Minnesota. The Twin Cities Metro is one of three chosen by the Obama administration to create pilot programs to prevent people from becoming radicalized into joining terror groups abroad. But some Muslims worry that the effort by law enforcement is really about gathering intelligence. Laura Ewan reports.
Minnesota's U.S. Attorney Andy Lugar says his program grew out of conversations with Somali American community members, including mothers worried about their sons. He says his plan for the initiative involves more after-school and mentoring programs for vulnerable youth.
I've met with hundreds, if not thousands, of community members to gather their thoughts on what we should be doing, and that is, in fact, what we're doing. So I've told people this has nothing to do with surveillance, it has nothing to do with investigations, and I'm telling the truth.
But he's fighting suspicions in some corners of the community. Those concerns grew this month after the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School released a couple of revealing documents. They showed that at the time of the documents, around 2009, two law enforcement outreach programs in the Twin Cities were designed to assist investigations. Both the FBI and St. Paul Police, however, say they backed off those goals and never gathered intelligence as part of those programs. Jaylani Hussein is executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Minnesota. His group and the Brennan Center are holding a forum tonight to raise concerns about the pilot program.
And we want to make sure that if the government says that they're here to do outreach, that they're doing outreach. You know, we don't want to have create untrust within that relationship that puts more burden on future cooperation.
One of the documents in question was a grant proposal by St. Paul Police to the Department of Justice. It proposed creating an outreach team of officers that would, in part, assemble a list of radicalized individuals in the Somali American community. But St. Paul Police Chief Tom Smith says his staff never did that. He says the program did allow officers to gain trust from Somali American kids, even if that meant taking them to play soccer and other sports.
If our intelligence gathers on a soccer field, in a swimming pool, in a bowling alley, that's just too much for me to comprehend. It's about building relationships, having documented and frank conversations right now about the threat from ISIS.
That doesn't mean the St. Paul police refrained from sharing information with the FBI. Smith says one mother confided that she was worried about her 14-year-old son. Smith says officers soon learned and later shared with the FBI that an adult recruiter was trying to send the boy to Somalia to join a terror group.
This young man was being recruited to go overseas to fight with Al-Shabaab, 14 years old. But we had a parent that gave us information that allowed us to learn more. The mother got to save her 14-year-old son from disappearing off the streets of the city of St. Paul.
One of the Muslim partners in the St. Paul program was Asad Zaman. He's executive director of the Muslim American Society of Minnesota. He says he knew that the program wanted to gather information on community members, but he drew a line there. He says he remembers a police official asking Zaman if he could record the names of people who attended the community meetings.
They explained to me a little bit of what they were trying to do, and we said that's not going to happen.
But Zaman says the relationship St. Paul police forged with the Muslim community was overwhelmingly positive. And yet, he's wary of the new federal pilot program to fight violent extremism. He points to examples in other parts of the country where law enforcement has been accused of spying on mosques while purporting to do outreach.
Do I have to wait for it to happen in my backyard before I start getting skeptical? I don't have to wait.
Andy Lugar, the U.S. attorney, says he understands those concerns about past practices. But he says his critics should focus on what he's trying to do, right here and right now. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A bill introduced in the Minnesota House would keep any videos recorded by police body cameras private. Sponsors say the cameras are likely to record embarrassing personal information about people dealing with police at extremely traumatic points in their lives. But others say if the videos are kept secret, it defeats the camera's purpose of serving as a check on police authority. Tom Scheck has more on the story.
A handful of police departments across Minnesota already are using body cameras. The devices are meant to capture officers interacting with the public, as in this video released by the Minneapolis Police Department last November.
Is that your dad?
Yeah.
Okay.
The video, which is part of a pilot program, shows an officer responding to a disturbance call.
Did we just have too much to drink tonight?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, obviously people are calling because people are out here yelling,
yeah,
right?
I'm sorry.
You're trying.
I get it.
I appreciate
really,
it. No,
really
I appreciate it. I appreciate you trying. I'm recording. All right.
State law requires body camera video like this to be public, but some lawmakers say it should be private to protect the public from embarrassing situations.
You could have a half-naked housewife that's been beat up with a bloody face, half-naked kids running around. You could have a gun collection. Those things need to remain private.
Republican Representative Tony Cornish of Vernon Center chairs the House Public Safety Committee. Cornish introduced a bill that would classify the video from body cams as private data, accessible only to law enforcement and the subjects of the video. He said privacy concerns and the cost of redacting data are the reasons to keep the videos confidential.
You aren't going to have huge amounts of footage of innocent people and put it in storage on a hard drive and then let everybody walk in and get it.
Cornish's bill also requires police departments to destroy any data not involved in an active or inactive criminal investigation after 90 days. DFL Senator Ron Latz of St. Louis Park says he agrees with Cornish's view that body camera video should be private. Latz, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, says there's urgency to act, considering some police departments are already using body cameras.
I don't think we have much of a choice but to struggle to get our arms around it. I mean, here's a case where technology's out a little bit ahead of, you know, our public policy.
The Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association says it supports Cornish's bill, but several groups are lining up in opposition. Ben Feist, with the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota, says body cam video should be public. He says that's the only way the public will know if a police officer crosses the line.
If you make it too private, the whole idea that we are able to use these body cameras to watch the police, to sort of turn this around and say this is surveillance of law enforcement, really falls by the wayside.
Feist said he's open to keeping some video private, including footage taken in a private residence or pictures of a police informant. But Minnesota Newspaper Association lobbyist Mark Anfinson said all the video should be public. Anfinson, who has represented several news organizations, including NPR News, says there are already privacy protections in place that address Cornish's concerns.
The more you talk about this and think through the ramifications of what sort of video may actually be acquired, it does get complex. But you know what? You can't let complexity paralyze you.
Others worry over what police will do with the video. Republican Representative Peggy Scott of Andover says police could look up, copy, and share certain video. Scott points to a case where a Department of Natural Resources employee looked up her and many other people's driver's license data.
And it's not a good feeling to know that you've been the subject of something like that. And I do not distrust law enforcement, but I know human nature.
Lawmakers hope they can compromise before the end of session, but some are already suggesting a commission may be established to study the issue if no agreement is reached by May. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Union officials say cuts to the IBM workforce have hit the company's Rochester facility. Elizabeth Baer reports.
IBM officials do not comment on job cuts, but Lee Conrad, national coordinator for the labor group Alliance at IBM, estimates several dozen Rochester workers have lost their jobs.
Just about everybody's getting hit inside IBM right now. Everything from system to software to IT specialists.
IBM reported 4,000 employees in Rochester in 2008, the most recent official count. But Conrad says the Rochester workforce is now more likely between 25 and 2,800 employees. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
Measles is in the news both nationally and locally. A 20-year-old student at the University of Minnesota's Twin Cities campus contracted the disease following a trip to Indonesia. And in a half dozen other states, nearly 100 people have measles linked to an outbreak that started at Disneyland. In a speech to members of the Minnesota Newspaper Association, infectious disease expert Michael Osterholm talked about how easily the virus spreads.
If I had measles right now in this room, even you in the back of the room would be in trouble. It really was brought home to me how infectious measles is when a few years ago, many of you recall, we had the International Special Olympics here in Minnesota when the old Humpty Dumpty was still around. And the opening night ceremony, we had not had measles indigenous in 18 months in Minnesota. And the opening night ceremony, each of the country's delegates came in from the garage door out in the right field, circled around the field, and then ended up plopping down and filled up basically almost the entire infield with all the different participants. Well, it turned out a young boy from Argentina was just in the throes of measles that night. Came in, marched around, sat right on home plate. Literally, that's where the A's were at. Well, 2 weeks later, we had a big outbreak in the people who participated, but we had a cluster of cases that had no contact whatsoever with the Special Olympics except for one thing. They all went to the opening night ceremony, and none of them knew each other. And guess what? They all sat in one section of the nosebleed seats at right field. And we did the smoke studies with the old Humpty Dome, and when some of the old managers used to think we rigged the air systems for when we were up to bat versus when the other teams were. I'm not so sure we didn't do that. But there was turbulent airflow where the air came out behind home plate, came off home plate, and it deposited up in that corner where Mark McGwire on steroids couldn't hit a home run. And that's where those people sat. That's how infectious measles is. It will find you if you are vulnerable. We'll see what's going to happen at the university over the next few weeks and the rest of it.
That was Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He spoke at the Minnesota Newspaper Association's annual convention. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Tomorrow is Bernadea Johnson's last day as superintendent of the Minneapolis School District. As frustration grows over the achievement gap between white students and students of color in Minneapolis, Johnson's departure puts the district at a crossroads. School officials, parents, and teachers are divided on whether the district should go ahead with efforts Johnson put in place or scrap them in favor of a fresh start. Tim Post reports.
More than 100 well-wishers showed up at Minneapolis Public School headquarters earlier this week to honor outgoing Superintendent Bernadea Johnson.
I just want to thank all the individuals who got up tonight.
The event gave Johnson a chance to reflect on her successes as head of the district. She counted among them a reduction in the number of suspensions for African-American students, an agreement to collaborate with charter schools, and a plan that aims to erase the achievement gap within 5 years. But in recent months, Johnson, as well as the school board, parents, and teachers, have expressed increasing frustration over the persistent gap in test scores and graduation rates between white students and students of color. For instance, last year, 33% of Native American students, 41% of Hispanic students, and 43% of black students graduated on time. That's compared to 72% of white students. Minneapolis School Board member Tracine Asbury says the district can't tolerate a divide in how it serves its students.
We can't ignore the facts, and everyone, every family, every child is not experiencing Minneapolis Public Schools the way that we want them to, and we want to be honest about that.
At the same time, Asbury is optimistic a new data-driven effort to provide struggling students with intense help will gain traction in coming years. It's called Acceleration 2020 and was approved by the board last fall. Bernadea Johnson championed the plan, but ultimately the new superintendent will decide whether it continues or if the district tries something new. School Board Chair Jenny Arneson says it's in Minneapolis's best interest to hire someone who will push the plan.
I think that we're really interested in not recreating a new idea, a new fundamental or foundational program every time somebody new comes.
That approach could make District CEO Michael Gore a favorite to replace Johnson. Gore will serve as interim superintendent and says he'll seek the permanent job. Former Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback wants Gore to get the job. Ryback is executive director of Generation Next, a group that's working with the Minneapolis and St. Paul districts on ways to close the achievement gap. Gore held the same position before becoming the district's CEO. Ryback says there's value in promoting Gore and continuing the efforts in place.
The continuity is helpful as long as it's not complacency, and there's a huge difference between them.
But some say a change in leadership is the perfect time to try something or someone new. Robert Panning Miller teaches social studies at South High School in Minneapolis, and he's a former head of the Minneapolis Teachers Union. He says the school board needs to consider candidates from across the nation. And he says the district should try something other than data-driven instruction to close the achievement gap. He admits data helps teachers understand how their students are doing, but says relying too much on test results could stifle innovation in the classroom.
Just pushing forward in the wrong direction is not wise. I mean, at some point, you need to recognize that this is not the direction to go.
LaDonna Redmond has two children in the Minneapolis district. Redmond also serves on a committee considering how the district should tackle the achievement gap. She says the next superintendent doesn't need to start a completely new approach to fixing the district's problems. But she says they'll need to have new ideas that bring immediate results.
Time is a luxury that we don't have. We need school systems that work right now.
The Minneapolis School Board is expected to discuss how it will go about finding its next superintendent at a meeting next month. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
In other education news, an attempt to give part-time working students a more equitable share of state financial aid hasn't worked out as planned. Alex Friedrich has more.
2 years ago, student organizations lobbied the state to prorate state grant awards according to how many classes they took. They wanted to enable part-timers to study more and work less. But simply prorating the award sent a lot of money to middle-income students who were already studying close to full-time. Senate Higher Education Committee Chairwoman Terry Bonoff says state officials are now considering ways to target the right students.
We might accomplish what we were looking to accomplish at a greater return.
The change affected a quarter of the students in the state grant program. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A Brooklyn Park man has pleaded guilty to charges he played part in a failed coup of the Gambian government, Peter Cox reports.
Court documents say 46-year-old Papa Fall joined about a dozen others in late December who attempted to overtake the state house in the West African nation. Several were killed. He and another man were able to escape. Defense attorney David Reyes says Fall pleaded guilty to reduced charges of conspiracy to violate the Federal Neutrality Act and conspiracy to export firearms without a license. He says Fall wanted to take responsibility for his participation in the coup attempt. Reyes anticipates Fall will be released from custody next week as he awaits sentencing. No sentencing date has been set. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And finally, for the first time, a Twin Cities suburb will open a shelter for homeless teens and young adults. Brooklyn Avenues, a new 12-bed shelter located in Brooklyn Park, will serve people ages 16 through 20 who have been kicked out of their homes or run away and have no safe place to go. There was no NIMBY fight over putting a teen shelter in this northwest suburb. Instead, supporters say a community recognized a need and came together. Sasha Aslanian reports.
Brooklyn Avenues is getting ready for teenagers.
We've gotten 12 bars of soap, 12 lip balm, 36 toothbrushes, 24 tubes of toothpaste.
Linda Forkey, a volunteer from Prince of Peace Lutheran Church in Brooklyn Park, lists the donations that have come in to stock the shelter while workmen put the finishing touches on the building. Barb Dahlquist, another volunteer from Prince of Peace, is a retired teacher who also felt drawn to help.
Every time we have these severe cold winter nights, I'm always concerned about those people who have nowhere to be out of the cold. And here I am in a nice warm house.
Young people are out in the cold or couch hopping at friends' houses or turning to strangers for help. Just ask Tony Weinbeck.
I am a lieutenant with Brooklyn Park Police Department on Dog Watch Patrol.
Dog Watch Patrol. That means Weinbeck commands the overnight shift. She says her officers come across kids who have run away and are easy prey for predators. She describes an all-too-common story.
Hey, I had run away from a group home. I ran away from my adoptive parents. I was staying here within 24 to 48 hours. Somebody had stopped. Some adult had stopped, pulled them into an apartment, and made them feel wanted, welcome. And they grab onto them, and they they victimize them.
One sex trafficking ring she investigated in 2011 involved 11 victims. Weinbeck says she turned to Brooklyn Park Mayor Jeff Lundy for help.
I was so passionate about it. I was pounding tables and telling him what the problem was, is that we just don't have the resources for those victims, for those runaways. And he took that and ran with it.
The city of Brooklyn Park spent nearly $1 million to build a shelter and brought in the Minneapolis nonprofit Avenues for Homeless Youth to run it. Avenues executive director Deb Loon shows off the tidy bedrooms that look like single dorm rooms, furnished with twin beds, desks, and armoires. Staff and residents at Avenues Shelter in North Minneapolis named the bedrooms after social justice and civil rights leaders and popular entertainers.
So we have the Muhammad Ali room, and the Selena room, and the Nelson Mandela room, and Obama.
Downstairs, Loon points to large common areas where they'll share meals.
The staff will prepare 3 meals a day. So when a young person moves in here, they'll get all their basic needs met, which is the first and most important thing for us to do, provide a safe, stable place for them, meet all their basic needs so they can stop worrying about that. And once they can stop worrying about that, then they can start to think about what they want for themselves and what their future might look like.
Loon says most residents will stay a few months while gaining skills to live on their own. Loon says faith and civic organizations, foundations, and government push to create Brooklyn Avenues, and she hopes the model will catch on in other Twin Cities suburbs.
Their collective goal is to create a safe place for their kids, so that they can stay in their community, continue to go to school, get the support they need, and remain community members here instead of having to leave and go to the city to get their help.
The ribbon cutting for Brooklyn Avenues will take place at noon today. Young people will begin moving in next week. Sasha Eslanian, Minnesota Public Radio News, Brooklyn Park.
Looking good.
And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, January 30th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.